Welcome to Conversations in MedEd, the people behind the research. Hi, everyone. Today I'm joined by one of my South African colleagues and friends, Simone. Hi, Simone.
Hi, Nikki. Hi, everyone.
Great. So maybe you could just introduce yourself to our listeners. So who are you? What do you do? And where do you work?
Yeah, so I'm Simone Titus. I work at the Center for Health Professions Education at Stellenbosch University's Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences. And although my work is in teaching and learning in health professions education, I take care of a focus lead in digital education and innovation, or which was formerly known as learning technologies. So my passion and what I do really is teaching and learning in health professions education with a special interest in the use of emerging technologies in not only health professions education, but higher education as a whole.
Yeah, very relevant. How did you get into health professions education? So what is your background? I know you were a physiotherapist or a biokineticist.
No. So that's the interesting thing. I actually had a conversation with a colleague earlier this morning, you know, speaking about how everybody's path is actually just so different. Yeah. So I started out in sports science.
And I
started out doing a degree looking at sport and exercise science. And then I realized I don't like the exercise component or something. But I really enjoyed the idea that I'm working in health sciences, and my other major was in psychology. And then I sort of did the sports science with psychology as another major with another specialization in sport management. And then I segued into gender studies of all things. And I looked at, and I did work around females and female leadership and how women are viewed I was going to say, looking at the gender biases of female leaders in traditionally male-dominated spaces, and I owe that probably to the sports science side of my work. Mm-hmm. And so that degree also, when I did my master's, was one that was straddling. So I did a lot of sports science, so a lot of kin anthropometry, so that is anatomy, structure, function, and location, motor control, sociology, psychology. You know, so I dabbled in not only the sciences, let's say the hard sciences, but also in the social sciences, and then in the sociology, which looked at the gender studies. And then I was teaching in health sciences or in sports sciences for probably about 10 years. And as I was teaching, I was using lots of technologies to facilitate students' learning or the experiences of in the classroom and outside of the classroom. And in that space, I ended up having a conversation with, at the time, her name is Vivian Boselick, and mm-hmm. I always say that she's a point of light. And what she did at the time was she came around, because teaching and learning wasn't really put on the map at institutions at the time. And she came around and she was speaking about this IOP and the teaching and learning charter and all of this. And it was gibberish to us, you know, what, 17 years ago. And so the language wasn't accessible, you know, because we're so used to using language in our own discipline. Now we're using educational language or language used in educational spaces to sort of understand the practices that we are actually implementing in our classrooms, but not actually being conscious about that. And so she had this project called Emerging Technologies in Higher Education, and it brought together 8 universities from 8 differently placed universities in South Africa, and they did a project on ICTs in higher education. And that was when I sort of pivoted into the teaching and learning space. And that's not even getting into health professions education, but by virtue of the fact that I pivoted into teaching and learning and I was working in health sciences at the time, it sort of organically emerged that I ended up in that environment. And it was in that working group that I'd met my PhD supervisor, Deacon Gambi, at the time. And I did a PhD in using game-based learning to facilitate cross-cultural learning in health sciences or in sports science at the time, because I was teaching sports psychology. And that, I almost want to say, and then the rest was history, because then I started networking. I got engaged with SAHI, which is the Southern African Association for Health Professions, for high health educationalists. Yeah. And I chair that committee in the Western Cape. So I ended up engaging in spaces that was predominantly health sciences and medical education. And up until today, I'm still in that space.
Yeah, I find health
professions. A bit of a long-winded.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, I find health professions education, as you said, it brings in together so many different worlds and disciplines from, you know, the health side or health sciences side to education, sociology, the digital, the higher education. So it's a really exciting space to be in. Where has your research gone since doing your PhD in sort of the gamification or game-based learning? What sort of is your research focus or area at the moment?
So you know how digital education sort of evolves and shifts quite rapidly,
yeah.
Not only in the world, but in higher education. And so in South Africa, it's not a slippery slope, but it's something that we really have to be conscious of because of access and the digital divide. And even though we give students access, I want to say, to either Wi-Fi or devices, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to use these things.
Yeah.
So my research shifted from using game-based learning. So my work actually developed digital games using prescribed textbooks to facilitate learning in the classroom. Now I'm still busy with some work in game-based learning with other colleagues in this particular faculty, currently doing one on POCUS, which is point of care ultrasound. And so they've developed a game, an underwater sea game that was developed actually in the Netherlands that we will be implementing here in the next semester. There's some other flashcard game development type of work that's been done. I also got a grant to look at the use of using virtual reality and augmented reality in higher education. So that project is complete. I did it while I was at UWC in my role as a teaching and learning specialist. So that was a project that spanned over 2 years, and it really looked at how we can use virtual reality and augmented reality to teach anatomy and physiology to students in health sciences. And currently, my project is now, projects have shifted. So I'm busy with work in AI. So
yeah.
Looking at how we use artificial intelligence to develop culturally sensitive stories for people who are diagnosed with things like type 2 diabetes or HIV. So we know that large language models are predominantly developed in the global north. And so it is inherently biased, and it creates stereotypes of people. And so we're trying to teach the large language models about our context, so that when we do request it to generate text or visuals or videos or any type of artifact for the African continent, that these, you know, that the outputs are contextually and reflexively relevant in our space. Yeah.
That's super.
So that's my latest sort of project. And then the other work that I'm doing is the development of, you know, putting together putting an immersive learning center for clinical anatomy together. So that would include using virtual reality as an immersive space for students to learn anatomy in health sciences.
You're very busy. You're doing some very exciting work. So obviously you're describing how technology is sort of really integrated within educational spaces, and it's sort of something we need to lean into and embrace. So do you have any practical recommendations for people who are maybe wanting to implement or use any sort of technology or, you know, AI? You've raised some sort of great points on being sort of critical on thinking, where was this tool or product developed? You know, what biases might be inherent? Is it applicable to our context or to our culture? So any sort of other takeaways or practical advice for practitioners?
Yeah, look, technology is not a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. I don't advocate for it all the time. I think you need to first consider what is the purpose?
Mm.
What is the learning outcome that you want to achieve? And can that be achieved using technologies? And so I always say students always have this in their hand.
Yeah.
And when I look at a student, my first question is, how do I get into that space?
Yeah.
How do I become one of the first things besides the WhatsApp and the Instagram chats and whatever it is, the DMs?
Yeah.
How do I get them to touch onto my work first? Mm-hmm. How do I make it lucrative. And so what we've been doing here was developing, and it's old ideas, is developing SCORM packages. So SCORM packages using different types of multimedia media products and putting it into one package. So student can then look at the SCORM. It's usually developed from the lecturers' PowerPoint presentations, but then we embed quizzes in. We embed the, you know, the YouTube clip or video or images that the lecturer may have taken in their own space, because many times here, they're already clinicians. But that is based on a learning outcome.
Mm.
And so it's not all learning outcomes require technology.
Yeah.
So my recommendation is always start small, you know. So if there's a video that you want to link to a presentation or an article that you did, that linking those types of things into spaces are simple ways in which students can use technology to engage in that space. Use your discussion forums if you have LMSs.
Mm-hmm.
Use your discussion forums in a way that allows for interaction. So, for example, don't leave a question then just, you know, ask students to write. Ask them to engage with it. And I hate doing this, but assess it.
Yeah.
Because assessment drives learning. So find innovative ways. Reels are also popular with students at the moment because they get content in very short bites.
Mm.
So you don't want to use a tool that is where they're going to have to be immersed in the space for long periods of time. So you don't want to put a YouTube video on that is an hour long.
Yeah.
If you do, cut them into short snippets. But it's about creating bite-sized information for students to use.
Yeah.
I think that's just my tip is go to your learning outcomes.
Yeah.
I think that will drive your decision in terms of which technology to use. So can I add something,
Nikki?
Yes, of
course.
So I often say that within a classroom, we often want to, even though there is a learning outcome, we often want to stimulate a particular type of outcome in the class. So either we want students to communicate, we want them to engage, we want to test their knowledge. So there are different applications to do that. So if you want engagement, find technology that allows for interaction and engagement. So if it's a quiz or, you know, a poll everywhere, a WooClap, it engages them. If you want to test their knowledge, use a Mentimeter, or if you have bigger classes, you may want to use something else like a Miro board or WooClap again.
Mm.
So it's about trying to also see what it is that you want to be able to do to in your classroom that is going to facilitate the learning. And even if you are flipping a classroom and saying, you know what, read this paper, and when we come into the class, we're going to have a discussion. You don't necessarily just need to have discussion. You could have a Q&A, like a competition quiz, and Mentimeter does this very well, where you can ask them questions and it becomes like you have a leaderboard and it becomes a game. You gamify the space and the class erupts in a hive of activity. So see what it is that you want out of your learning outcome and out of your classroom engagement.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice, because it comes back to the basics of something like constructive alignment. Make sure that whatever activity you're doing is aligned to the learning outcome, and things like chunking or scaffolding, where you're you're supporting students in those bite-sized, sort of digestible learning moments where they're not sort of overwhelmed or cognitively overloaded. And I think like the gamification, bringing fun into the classroom, you know, if we want to encourage lifelong learning, that should be a joy and not a hardship or a burden. And so bringing in those fun tools to engage different students in different ways and to bring excitement, I think, is great advice.
Edutainment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we all have our devices and we're sort of doom scroll or chronically online.
Yeah.
So make the content worthwhile and useful for students.
And also, if we're doing that, our students are likely doing that too. So I think we also need to adopt a sort of compassionate learning mindset that, you know what, our students are also overloaded. You mentioned cognitive load. They are also overloaded. They are also overstimulated. You do not also want to create more content that is going to, compound that situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think just maybe pressing pause and thinking, is this fit for purpose, as opposed to just doing it because it's available, and sort of adding more stress and more content to often overloaded curricula too.
Yeah.
Maybe just sort of switching tracks a bit to thinking about your journey into the field of health professions education. Were there any sort of big learning moments that you found very helpful or advice you would give to someone perhaps thinking of doing a master's or PhD in health professions education?
That's an interesting question. And thank you for the question, Nikki. I think that it depends on where in the career the person is. So very often when we find people who are emerging scholars, very often you also find that people at that age are either young or may be thinking of having a family or have young families. And so there's lots of dynamics that are at play. So I often have mentoring and coaching conversations with those people to ask, what is your 2-year goal? What is your 5-year goal? What's your 10-year goal? Because I think if you don't know what that is and what your purpose is, it's going to be very difficult for you to say, oh, I want to go into health professions education. What is your why? So my question to people always is, what is your why? What is your passion? What is your purpose? And if you don't know what that is, go and find it.
Yeah.
Go sit with yourself. Or with someone, maybe a coach to unpack, or a mentor to unpack what that is. And so it really is a journey. And so find my advice is to find a mentor to guide you on the path. So if you are looking at health professions education, find somebody who you can, not just one, maybe multiple mentors, who can talk you through some of the highs and the lows of working in this environment. I personally find it extremely rewarding because I can live out my passion, which is to serve. You know, in a way that is rewarding for me, but I also see the fruits of my labor in terms of people who adopt some of the strategies that I offer. The other thing is, I think, be strategic in terms of your partnerships. In that partnerships, make sure that the mentors and the people that you partner with have your best interest at heart as well, and that they are guiding you sort of in the right path. Make sure that they are open to sharing opportunities, whether it's with funding or professional development. Make sure that there are people in your environment that are able to offer that to you. The other thing is, if you've moved beyond being an emerging scholar and you're somebody that's a little bit more established and you're looking to pivot, again, it's going to be important for you to answer your what is your why. Why is it that you want to move across? I'm finding many clinicians who are also teachers didn't realize how much passion they have actually for teaching. And so now the pivot and the move is starting, and the development of the, I don't use the word capacity development, you know, the professional skills in terms of health professions education, the teaching and learning knowledge, the understanding of assessment. So as they're growing all of these things, they're also pivoting and moving into different spaces. So for me, it's what is your why?
I think that was one of the first things my PhD supervisor asked me. He said, just know your why. It doesn't matter what it is, but it needs to be clear, because that's often the light at the end of the tunnel. When things get dark or it gets hard, you have that reason or that motivation sort of guiding you and keeping you going, because it's not always an easy or straightforward journey.
Yeah, it's not rainbows and butterflies. but it's rewarding at the end of the day. So, yeah.
Definitely. Maybe just to end off, I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add, but also just thinking from a South African perspective, you've raised really interesting things such as like the digital divide and, you know, access doesn't just mean physical access, but epistemological access, or things like cultural sensitivity or bias in tools developed in the global north. Any other sort of comments around that? Because I often find South Africans, I'm South African, and so this is my bias, but we're often leading the way in health professions education. And yet, just because we are somewhat marginalized or not as well represented in the field, such these great things that we're doing is often lost. So any sort of, if you want to stand on your soapbox or any takeaways or anything you really want to sort of share that you think South African researchers are doing really well?
I think that South African researchers have been doing wonderful, remarkable work for many, many years in under-resourced spaces.
Yeah.
And that is what has made them extremely creative in terms of the type of educational delivery that they offer to their students. And so very often we don't get published in papers that in papers where publishing houses are housed in the global north. Why is that? You know, and then 5-10 years down the line, I read a paper and I'm like, but I was doing this 10 years ago. And, you know, yeah. this paper cited a million times. And so it's around partnerships. We need to also build our partnerships with our colleagues in the global north so that there is a knowledge exchange and that it is not this top-down approach where, you know, global north, we are the bastions of knowledge, but also there needs to be an acknowledgement, a real acknowledgement and appreciation for the type of work and research that is being done in the global south. I'm at the point now where I do podcasts and we're busy with a podcast series, and it's not, you know, about how did you get into the health professions education, but it's about taking the research that has been done in the global south in health professions education, and we speak about your research so that we can start citing, we must cite ourselves.
Yes.
You know, I'm not going to be citing, and no disrespect, Nikki, and it's not, I'm not trying to say this to be offensive. I'm not going to cite Sims, who is at Oxford University, when we can be citing somebody down the corridor saying similar things. And so it's about acknowledging the type of work that we are doing in the global south, but also, you know, pushing an agenda to say, you know what, we actually do know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I was at a very big medical education conference last year, and it just reaffirmed that what we are doing, you know, on our continent is really brave. And it's really creative, and it really has impact with much, much, much less resources. And so it makes me really proud to be South African, to be African, and to look at and to see and to witness the type of work that we do and the type of research that that is happening in our space. And even if we are not being published in Nature or Medical Teacher or you know, I'm still proud of the type of work that we are producing. And it's really, I'm not criticizing the publishing houses. I'm just saying that we are doing exceptional work down south. So come.
Yes, we'll show you. Yeah, partner with, so those who are in the global north, partner with those in the global south. And it should be, again, equitable, not sort of that tokenistic, you know, I've included some from South Africa. It needs to be meaningful. It needs to be about really listening, because as you say, we have things to say. We don't need anyone to amplify our voice. We have our own voice. Just give us the mic.
It needs to be an equal partnership. And I think that is what we should be advocating for. And I know that there are disparities, especially economically. So, you know, when we apply for funding, for example, we will get 100,000 rands, but you will get 5,000 pounds.
Yeah.
It's double the amount.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. And so all we're saying is, let's meet in the middle. The partnership needs to be equitable for everyone. It needs to be an equal partnership that everybody gains in the exact same way.
Yeah, I agree. Well, when your podcast is up and running or you're releasing episodes, please do let me know. Yeah. And I can include those details in the show notes, because I will be listening. And I'm sure many people would love to listen to that.
That would be much appreciated. Thank you, Nikki.
Well, thank you for your time, Simone.
You're welcome. It was lovely seeing you again.
Definitely. Chat soon.
I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, 2-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics theory and evidence from the field and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage. Links can be found in the show notes.